If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver 3 essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. For today's podcast, we've got a conversation about women's roles in the Viking world with Johanna Katrin Friedrichsdottir. Johanna is the author of a new book on the subject, Valkyrie, and putting the questions to her was our content director, David Musgrove.
I'm very excited about our next podcast interview, which is with Dr. Johanna Katrin Friedrichsdottir, and she will tell me if I've pronounced that really badly, I hope, but that's my best try at it. She has taught at Yale University and held research posts in Reykjavik and at Harvard, and she currently works at the National Library of Norway in Oslo. Her research focuses on Vikings, Old Norse, Icelandic sagas, mythology and poetry, medieval manuscripts and gender, and she's written a really brilliant book, which is called Valkyrie, Women of the Viking World. So first up, Johanna, do you just want to explain a bit about your choice of the title? Your first chapter is actually focused on these Valkyries. It talks about them. So do you just want to tell us what's a Valkyrie and why did you choose this title?
Thank you for that brilliant introduction. The title, I suppose, is something that a lot of people associate with Viking women when they hear that phrase. Valkyries are these wonderful, scary, strong creatures, and famous from Wagner's operas and that sort of thing. And I suppose just having a one-word striking title draws you in, and then clarifying with the women of the Viking world, who in some ways were Valkyries, being strong and determined and so on.
Okay. And do you just want to, just for sake of clarity, just talk a little bit about the Viking world that you're talking about here, just very quickly? What's the chronology and geography of the area you're talking about?
Yes, the Viking world is Scandinavia and the places where the Vikings went. So the British Isles, Iceland, Greenland, even North America, and then east into the down the Russian rivers and so on. So it's a really, really vast geographical scope. And then it's quite a big chronological scope as well, because the Viking Age sort of proper begins around 800, but there's maybe a few decades before where things are sort of gearing up for it. And then it ends around 1100. So we're talking about, 300 years, give or take. So that the Viking world is a really big world, and it's impossible to do it completely justice. But, I tried to give a really good overview of the general things that were happening, the changes and social structures and what people were up to at the time.
Okay, so your book is broadly divided into the life stages of a Viking woman: childhood, teenage, adulthood and marriage, pregnancy, motherhood, widowhood, and old age and death, which seems eminently sensible and is a good way to approach it. One thing that immediately sort of comes out of that is, what's the average sort of lifespan of a woman during this period and an area? What sort of time period were people living to?
Well, they probably didn't always live for very long. Child mortality was really high, and lots of people died kind of very young. And then old age was sort of 40s, which we would find a little bit sad now, I think. People got married much younger, and life sort of goes much faster in a way compared to the way we live now. But we do have evidence that people reach, their 70s or so. The woman who was buried in the Oseberg grave, the famous Viking burial, she was over 70 years old when she died. So, they did live for a long time as well. But
okay, so quite a condensed life story for most of the people involved, though. So why now is it a good time to consider the role of women in the Viking period? Has it not been looked at much before? Is there any new evidence or sources of evidence that you've been able to look at, or any new ways of interrogating the sources that we've got?
That's a really good question. We have had evidence, archaeological evidence and sagas for a really long time, but there are always new approaches and then new burials and so on that are coming out as well. So we understand the sagas in a very, very different way from, only 50, 100 years ago maybe. And people are using, in my case, different literary analyses, anthropological approaches, and so on. And gender, obviously, being my focus, I think about gender in maybe a very different way from in the 80s or the 50s or so on. And then we are getting a lot of kind of new evidence from the archaeological stuff with, isotope analysis and DNA analysis and so on. So trying to synthesize all of this evidence and all this data is sort of my goal here. And then I think gender is never something that goes completely out of fashion, but it's definitely something that is really, really relevant and kind of topical at the moment. So it did seem like a good time to bring this book out, I guess.
Okay. So you were just talking about the sagas in your previous answer, and you do draw on the sagas for much of your story. So perhaps we could just have a little chat about what they were, and you could remind us a bit about what those sagas were. So they're basically written later than our period, aren't they? And most of they were written down in Iceland. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. They are these prose accounts that are really, really brilliant. And if you've never read a saga, I would highly recommend picking up something like Njál's Saga or Laxdæla Saga. So they are these prose narratives that are similar to novels, and they tell really good stories that are set in the Viking Age. And they often have poetry, bits of poetry that are sort of embedded in the prose, and they sort of they're used almost like footnotes. So it's like the authors are citing their sources. And so we know that a lot of this poetry is probably from the Viking Age proper, because it sort of can be dated that far back. And I won't go into the technicalities of that, but we know that kind of these poems, they sometimes talk about battles and named people from the Viking Age. And there's even a runestone in Sweden that talks about one of the characters, Theodoric, on the Rökstone. And that character crops up in a poem in Iceland, actually, in an Eddic poem. And so we kind of know that people were telling all of these stories from the Viking Age, and then they were just passing them down. And then something happens in Iceland in the 13th century, and they start writing all of this down on parchment, basically. And so we can't really rely on the sagas, you know, for kind of specific conversations or, you know, always characters. But we know that there's some truth in them, that, you know, people did travel to a lot of the places that are mentioned in the sagas, and that's corroborated by archaeology. Also, the social structures are very similar to what was probably the fact in the Viking Age. And the social structures sort of make people behave in certain ways and have subscribed to certain values and so on. And so even if they're written by these 13th century people, we can kind of use them, you know, as sources for the Viking Age, just provided that we do it well.
Yeah, brilliant. And I would absolutely agree that they are amazing things to read. I've brought along my well thumbed copy of I'm going to mispronounce it, but I think it's Eyhil's Saga, isn't it?
Yes.
Which is an absolute. I mean, it's not, this stuff isn't at all dry, isn't it? Eyhil's Saga is one of the most bloody, brutal stories you'll ever read, but it you know, it's great storytelling for one thing, isn't it? So they're worth reading for that, if nothing else.
Absolutely. I've taught that saga several times, and my students always turn up completely sort of bewildered and traumatized and saying, oh, this is like Game of Thrones or something. And I mean, the queen in Eyhil's Saga, she is a little bit like Cersei Lannister. Just doesn't hesitate at screwing people over, and kind of, and Eyhil obviously being this swashbuckling kind of Viking hero and sailing all around. But then he has this amazing capacity for grief and vulnerability, and, you know, it's just such a wonderful saga.
Yeah. And that's Queen Gunnhild you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Maybe we'll come back to her in a minute, because there's a couple of things that she does and
absolutely
says that might inform our conversation. But just sort of thinking about the topic of your book, women in the Viking world, we can't just talk about women in isolation here. Obviously, they fitted into the wider social setup of the Vikings, which I guess a lot of people coming to this subject would tend to see that as a patriarchal one, where men ruled the roost. And you say at one point in your book that it's not altogether convincing to brand Norse society as oppressive of women. And at another point, you say that it would be hard to imagine the Vikings would have been as successful as they were if they hadn't allowed women to assert themselves. So I guess that the first question here is the Viking world a man's world or not? What's your view on that?
I don't think it is, no. I mean, when we think about Vikings, the kind of popular cliche is really masculine, obviously. But for the first thing, they wouldn't have been born if there hadn't been women, and they wouldn't have been as strong maybe as they became. But I just think if you take women completely out of the narrative, then you really lose a vital aspect of it. They're there, they're participating in politics, they're being entrepreneurs, they're making the sails that you know enabled the Vikings to sail around, and they're also instilling some of the sort of values into them when they're children. So I think we really need to incorporate them into some of the more popular narratives, maybe.
Yeah. Well, and just picking up on that point, you mentioned the sails there. One of the most interesting things I found in your book, one of the most fascinating facts was that these sails on the Viking ships, you reckon would have taken like an immense amount of work and time to produce. You don't tend to think of that for sails, but go on, tell us a bit about that. I think you said that they would have taken a group of people a whole winter to produce one sail,
yes,
or something like that.
I know. I mean, I will be the first to admit I never really thought about this very much at all before I started researching the book. But it turns out that the sail is as valuable as the ship, probably. And it just takes an enormous amount of resources to make one. I mean, it's about 100 square meters, maybe, so 10 by 10 or so meters on a sort of Viking ship, and the ship's not going to go very far. I mean, you can row it, but you can't like row it across the Atlantic, so you need a sail. And for the sail, you need, you know, so many sheep or the wool from the sheep, and you know how to you have to know how to process the wool, and then you have to weave it, and it just takes so much time and so much expertise, and you have to treat it in a certain way to make it windproof, and so it's just a really long process and labor intensive and expensive.
It's crazy, isn't it? You just don't think, yeah, of that at all, do you?
No,
think it's a sail.
I know.
And was this, yeah, was this women's work? Was that something that women specifically would have been charged with doing?
Most of the evidence, I mean, I wouldn't rule out that there were some men involved, but most of the evidence suggests that this was more or less a woman's business. So they would have been the ones who were processing the wool and doing all the weaving and so on. But then there's also sort of, it's quite likely that they might have been driving the businesses, you know, organizing it, organizing the workers, and so on. And there are these women's graves that have like textile tools in them. And people often kind of think, oh, they probably must have used textiles or used the tools when they were alive. But some archaeologists think that they were more symbolic and so would have indicated some kind of prominent role in the textile business. So yes, we think that sails are something that are not very sexy when you're talking about Vikings necessarily. The ships are so beautiful with their prows and everything, but the sail was completely indispensable.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. I guess we talked a bit about sort of the gender makeup of Viking society, but we should also talk about the stratigraphy of that society. How different was the lived experience of a high status woman from that of a lowborn one, of a slave? And which sort of person are you most looking at in your book?
Well, I try to give insights into everyone's lives as much as, you know, I can, as much as there's evidence for. So, I mean, when I talk about enslaved people, I try to sort of discuss a little bit their conditions from literary evidence and archaeology. So there's a really new, interesting archaeological study that suggests that the slaves sometimes had to sleep in the same quarters as the animals. And so they kind of might have been considered even subhuman. And then there's this really amazing Old Norse poem that talks about these two slave women grinding flour, and they're sort of walking through the mud, and the poet describes how their feet are really cold. And I think there's some evidence that they probably weren't wearing very much clothing because textiles were so expensive that you wouldn't have given a slave very much fabric, you know, for clothing and leather for shoes or anything like that. And then, you know, you kind of get up to the more free farming class, and there's, you know, a fair amount of evidence from the sagas about what life might have been like for maybe a woman who was a farmer and maybe running, you know, a textile business on the side or something. And then we get all the way up to the top and, you know, again, talking about the Oseberg queen or ruler. I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the woman who was buried in this Oseberg burial mound, or there were two women, sorry, but I guess the focus has always been on kind of one of them having been a ruler and the other one having been sacrificed or gone with her in death or something like that. But the amount of grave goods that were put into the grave with these two women is just astounding. I mean, the lavishness of the burial suggests that they must have been held in extremely high esteem and had very high social status. And then in the sagas, you find these kind of women not necessarily being like a single monarch, but certainly co-ruling with husbands or sons. So, yeah, I tried to give a big overview of what life might have been like for different people.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Shield maidens only exist in these kind of more fantastical spaces. And when you get into the more realistic sagas, you know, there's not really a shield maiden among the Viking armies.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
One of the things I found quite fascinating in your book, of many things in it actually, but was the section where you're talking about the lives of young women before they get married. And there's a nice phrase you have that is, life could be exciting for a woman in the Viking age. And then you sort of describe that before they got married, Viking women often had, you know, quite exciting adventures, and they seem to have been quite free to travel. What was going on there? Is that right? Was there a certain stage in life that women were able to have a bit more freedom than they might have had otherwise?
Well, I think that's in the sagas mostly. I don't think that women had that much freedom on average, but the sagas have these amazing accounts of, for example, the woman I talk about in the book, who is Astrid Olafsdottir, the daughter of the Swedish king Olaf. And she travels to Norway to propose marriage to the Norwegian king. And I mean, we'll never be able to know whether this actually happened or not, but it's mentioned in a few different prose accounts, and so there seems to be something to the story. And I kind of just imagine how astounded people must have been when she shows up with maybe an entourage and proposes to the king, because she kind of sees that otherwise there's probably going to be a war between her father and that king. And then you have all the stories about these shield maiden who, before they get married, they sort of have the life of a Viking and they sail around and basically act like men. but I tried to sort of juxtapose that fantasy image with the reality, which was probably a lot harsher, that suggests that women, young women, were just, they would more or less marry the man they were told to marry, and that they wouldn't have very much choice there, and that marriages were sort of contracted to form alliances, and the family would decide. So I think there's quite an interesting juxtaposition between these stories of these women who are sort of flying around Scandinavia, and then the more sort of realistic stories.
And you mentioned shield maidens there, and this idea of Viking women being warriors, and that's obviously something that's on people's minds at the moment a bit, with various representations of such women as warriors in modern TV and films. And then we have the famous burial from Birka of a woman who has been described as a warrior recently, which got a lot of media attention. So can you just sort of unravel that story a bit for us, unpick it? Is it what is the evidence, if there is any at all, for Viking women actually being warriors that in the way that we perhaps see them on our TV screens today?
Yeah, it's a huge question, really fascinating, and I could probably talk about it for several hours, but if we try to just boil it down, there's that famous Birka grave that you mentioned, where a woman or a skeleton that has been analysed, and the DNA says that this is a biological woman. And then this person is buried with all kinds of weapons and tools that are gendered as both male and warrior. And then the location of the grave is also, you know, close to the kind of garrison in Birka. And so the kind of classic interpretation of the grave before the DNA was analyzed was that this was a high status warrior. But what turns out is interesting, that the bones don't actually have any sort of, you know, wounds, and they're not like dense in the way that suggests that the person might have trained a lot. So it kind of prompts a lot of questions about, you know, what is a warrior? Any grave with lots of weapons, does that just equal a warrior, or does the skeleton kind of need to have signs of having fought? Because we also find graves where little boys have been buried, you know, in a whole kit for a warrior, and like they obviously wouldn't have been using it at the time of death, but that was maybe the role that was intended for them. And then kind of thinking about the realities of being a warrior, you know, you're in this kind of masculine war band, and then there's maybe a woman. I mean, is when you don't have any contraception, for example, in a modern way, I mean, is it sort of realistic to think that you would have been able to exist in this sort of space and had this sort of lifestyle if you were a woman? So in these, so in the sagas, you have these examples of these women. For example, in Hervara saga, she is an only child, and she decides that she wants to be a Viking. And so she goes and becomes a Viking and asks her mother to outfit her as you would a son. And then what's really interesting is that the saga narrator switches the pronouns from she to he, and this character adopts a male name, Hervarður. And so you sort of wonder whether this is some kind of way for the narrator to talk about a person who we would describe as trans. And you sort of wonder whether this grave, for example, the Birka grave, whether that might have been, if it was a warrior indeed, whether that would have been someone who would have identified as a woman or identified as a man. And so there's just so many complicated aspects to this story. And I think what's maybe interesting from my point of view, you know, having a general interest in the Viking Age, is that, for example, I found the sails so interesting, and like, why is there so much focus on one grave? I don't know what you would say, but is that some kind of the intense focus on one grave? Like, doesn't that just say that we are so interested in whether women can do all the same things that men can do? And does it also maybe prompt questions about, you know, why do we think that warriors are so amazing and violence is something that is powerful and to be maybe not admired, but sort of understood as having agency? And there's just so many different images of these women, the Viking women, having agency in all kinds of ways, political and economic, and taking land and traveling and so on. And so why are we focusing so much on warriors when, you know, if it was a reality, it probably was a very small section of society? And why isn't it cool to be, you know, an entrepreneur who makes sales and makes lots of money that way and gains status? I think there's a lot of things to kind of think about when we think about shield maidens. But certainly in the sagas, I mean, shield maidens only exist in these kind of more fantastical spaces. And when you get into the more realistic sagas, you know, there's not really a shield maiden among the Viking armies. And in Heimskringla, for example, which is this long prose story about the Norwegian kings and the kind of domestic struggles that were happening in Norway in the Viking Age. There's a lot of hedging and so on.
Okay. Well, you haven't done an hour on that yet, but that's still a good summation of the situation. So thank you. So I suppose it sounds like you don't find these representations in the Amazon Prime and Netflix series of these sort of Viking warrior women. I forget, is it Lagertur in one of them? You don't find them very useful or in terms of getting people to understand this period?
Well, I mean, they're really entertaining. And so if they get someone interested, then I think that's great. And then they might just want to go further into thinking about the sources that we have and how we can use them, for example. And I know that's really boring. I would say, you know, for anyone who's interested in understanding characters like Lathgerða, you know, burial archaeology is a big field. How to use written sources is another big field. It's just a really big debate, and I think it just says so much about our own society.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we just talk a little bit about marriage and divorce, because you brought that up earlier, and you pointed out that marriage for Viking women was not necessarily something that they had much say in. I think you were saying that tended to be that they would have been forced to marriage, or a partner would have been chosen for them, and they wouldn't have had much say in it. So is that right? That's the basic story,
basically, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. What was the experience of being married for a Viking woman? Was that a good experience for them? Was it something that they sort of aspired to? Do we have any sense of that? Or was it just something that happened to them and there wasn't really any other choice?
There's not a lot of career options, certainly apart from marriage. I think probably if you at all could marry, you probably wanted to, because that just sort of you would gain a certain social status. You would have some modicum of economic independence and so on. And you would probably just hope that you got a nice husband. But it was really not up to the woman herself, usually. This story about this woman going off to Norway and proposing is a real sort of one-off. And most of the time, the sagas just depict, you know, young women when they're sort of 14, 15. Their father often just announces that now they're going to get married, and they do. And married life itself, I mean, the sagas, they just run the whole gamut of human relationships, really. And so you find couples that are extremely harmonious. There's obviously, you know, the saga author is depicting them as very loving and loyal to each other. And then there's kind of couples who clearly despise and loathe each other, but they still stay together because it's just kind of practical. And then you have certainly accounts of divorce, and also women kind of instigating the death of their husbands even. But yeah, it's really a fundamental aspect of life in the Viking Age.
And did Viking women have, you kind of just alluded to this now, did they have more or less authority or independence or agency as wives, as opposed to being unmarried? Was it, did it sort of improve their social status and condition to be married?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you're not married, I mean, most of the time you're probably a servant, or, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you're living with maybe your brother or something like that. But I mean, at least in the sagas, like literally everyone gets married who isn't a servant. And then, so if you are married and you have, you know, control of your own household, then that sort of gives you, legally, as a woman, you're allowed to spend a certain amount of money without asking your husband. And you're allowed to, you know, have a sort of say in things, and you're allowed to inherit. And so you have an amount of legal rights that you wouldn't have otherwise. And then you can sort of involve yourself in the politics of the family. And I mean, it's really something that like being single is just not like a concept really in the same way as we understand it.
Okay. But then on the flip side of that, there's divorce. So let's talk about that a bit, because you say in your book at one point, if I've understood it correctly, that women could be divorced on the spot by a man. Is that right?
That seems to be the case. I mean, it's really difficult to say, you know, from these sagas and laws that were written down a little bit later, you know, what actually happened. But there are sort of so many different versions of people getting divorced in the sagas that there must have been some cases of it. And then there is this example in Njáls saga where there's this wedding and there's an older man, and he's kind of leching on this young girl who's only 14, and his wife says something about it at the wedding and just, you know, stop ogling her, and he just divorces her and she gets cast out of the wedding, and, you know, in the saga she's never heard of again. And I mean, you know, it's difficult to say whether someone would have been divorced as abruptly as that, but certainly, I mean, there's also a case where a woman gets out of a marriage that she doesn't want to be in by kind of underhanded tactics. And so yeah, it's like not something that's necessarily a great option for people, and, you know, it causes some amount of scandal and so on. But yeah, it seems to be sort of, you know, it's a fairly, the Vikings were sort of quite pragmatic in many ways.
Yeah, you say, but, say at one point that you see divorce as a fact of life rather than a moral failure for the Vikings. So that gives an interesting insight, I guess, into their mindset.
Yeah, but like, you know, it's not often an option. Like if you're a woman and you're in this desperately unhappy marriage, like what is your option, alternative option? I mean, you can't just like move somewhere and set up on your own necessarily. I mean, there's just like realistically, you need things like an income and, you know, just a way of supporting yourself. And if you're a high status woman, you're not going to, you know, divorce someone and go off and be a servant somewhere, probably. So you kind of need the support of your family. And if, for example, I take this woman, Thurir, in a saga called the Eyrbyggja saga, and she's married to one of her brother's supporters. And so she knows that if she tries to divorce the husband, her brother would just not support her in that. And so she's definitely stuck in that marriage. So even if, you know, it's a legal right, I don't really think that it was always, you know, an option for many women.
Okay. So, but in terms of financial independence, how much scope did Viking women have for developing financial independence? Were they able to engage in craft and trade and entrepreneurship if they were within a marriage or, I guess, outside of marriage?
Yeah, I mean, the evidence seems to... Sorry. The evidence suggests that that women were, for example, active in the textile industry. All these women buried with kind of textile tools and so on. And I mean, we don't really know, like, you know, when you look at a grave, you can't really know for sure whether a woman was married or a widow. But certainly, I mean, I kind of have this hypothesis that maybe if you were able to move away from a rural area and into a town, you could maybe be a little bit more anonymous and get away from your interfering family. And like if you were successful in a trade, then you probably had a lot more of a chance to be autonomous and independent. But certainly, I think probably a lot of women who were married were kind of running all sorts of, you could call it cottage industries, on the side, you know, apart from just subsiding on their farm.
Okay. I've still got a whole bunch of questions, but we're running out of time a bit. So there's one that I think people are really interested in. So we're going to try and tackle that. So I looked on Google search to see what people are asking in relation to Viking women. And it's all about what they look like and what they wore. And you do cover that in your book. And for some reason, people are fascinated in what Viking women wore. So what did Viking women wear?
Well, I think they must have looked fabulous, many of them. They wore clothes that in some ways, I think, appeal to us a lot today. Like the silhouettes were quite sort of fitted, I guess, not to waste a lot of fabric. And then they had these brooches, at least the kind of classic Viking look. I mean, not everyone everywhere all the time wore them, but they had these two oval brooches on each side of their chest, like on sitting under the shoulders, and they would be kind of holding up their dress. And the clothes were usually made out of wool, and only rich people could afford linen. And they would probably be wearing all sorts of shawls and kind of coats. And like rich people, they would be really flaunting their wealth. They would have lots of brooches that it was often actually stuff that was stolen from the British Isles or, you know, Ireland or somewhere. They would, you know, pick clasps off manuscripts or something like that, or sort of altar paraphernalia, and then they would like attach a pin to it and then they would use them as brooches. And probably women had, like married women would have had something covering their hair, And the hairstyles were usually like these kind of ponytails, often with coils around the base. We have evidence.
How do we know that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, there's these picture stones. There's this island in the Baltic, right off Sweden, called Gotland, and they had this amazing tradition there that they raise these stones, picture stones, with carvings that are extremely elusive, and we don't really know always what they're depicting, and there's all kinds of interpretations. But the women's hairstyles there are often used to kind of try to reconstruct what women looked like. And they often have these trailing dresses as well. And then the Oseberg burial had this tapestry in it that has some human figures. And then there's like various other stones that have these carvings on them. And so that's how we reconstruct what people looked like.
It's fascinating. Like I say, this is such a fascinating topic. I could keep asking you for ages, but we need to kind of get to an end. So I suppose the question I always like to ask at the end is, what question should I have asked you? What haven't we talked about that would have been interesting to talk about?
Oh, gosh. Maybe there's a lot of people who are interested in Viking magic.
Okay, let's talk about Viking magic. Yeah, love potions and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's this prophetess figure that's called a vulva. I know it sounds like a naughty word. Sorry. There's this kind of... like she's almost like a witch in some stories, but she's more of a soothsayer and a prophetess in other sagas. And she kind of comes and tells people's prophecies. And like in Eirik's saga, the saga of Eirik the Red, which is set in Greenland, there's this scene when there's a really bad spell in terms of weather, and everyone's kind of beginning to starve and be very anxious about the future. And then this soothsayer woman comes, and there's this intricate description of her ritual, and she has to have special food, and she has like a special staff and all kinds of things. And then she sort of, you know, she tells everybody's prophecy and says everything will be all right. And then everything does turn out okay. And then there are these women's graves that have been found where there are these like staffs and things that people can't really explain properly. So they think that they might have been these ritual magicians
So it's pretty wild to think about that, isn't it? And obviously, this it sort of reminds us that this is all in the pre-Christian context, isn't it? This whole story is before the Viking people were converted to Christianity. So lots of bits of the society that I guess we're always going to struggle to understand because we're quite a remove from it.
Yeah, and we're just trying to piece together sources that can't speak. And so, you know, if you find a stick in a grave, like, is it a special wand, magic wand, or is it, you know, did it have some other purpose that we just is lost to us? You know, maybe it was like a symbol of authority, like a, you know, scepter or something. We don't know.
Okay, one more thing, which is slightly askance from what we've been talking about, but we talked about the sagas a bit earlier, and you said how good they were to read, and we agreed about that. If there was one saga that you were going to recommend our listeners read, which one should they go for?
Well, I think Egil's saga is actually a really fantastic place to start because it's just so much fun, and it has Queen Gunnhild, who is such an amazing character. But otherwise, the saga of Hervor, the Shield Maiden, might be interesting as well.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thank you so much for that fascinating conversation. And as I said, the book is called Valkyrie, Women of the Viking World. It's got a really striking cover, so you won't miss it in the bookshops. It's on sale April the 2nd, we think. Like I said, it's a cracking read with lots of fascinating information, you know, not just about women, but about things like the sales and things like that, stuff you just simply wouldn't think about. So well worth reading. So Johanna Katharine Friedrichsdotter, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Dave.
That was Johanna Katrin Friedrichsdotter. Her book, Valkyrie, The Women of the Viking World, is out now, published by Bloomsbury. You can find plenty more material on both women's history and the Vikings at our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next on Monday when I'll be talking to Catherine Fletcher about the Renaissance artist Artemisia.